Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. An impassioned personal message from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been released thanking medical professionals everywhere for their courage during the COVID-19 pandemic. Timed to coincide with World Health Day on Tuesday, the 7th of April, Mr. Guterres explains how we are more deeply grateful than ever to all those working round the clock and putting yourselves at risk to fight the pandemic. Latest figures from the World Health Organization indicate well over 1.2 million cases of new coronavirus infection worldwide and 68,000 deaths. From nurses and midwives to technicians, paramedics, pharmacists and doctors, the UN chief also thanks drivers, cleaners, administrators and many others who work day and night to keep us safe.
In these traumatic times, I say to all healthcare workers, we stand with you and we count on you. You make us proud. You inspire us. We are indebted to you. Thank you for the difference you are making every day and everywhere.
Staying with health professionals, new UN research has highlighted how nurses on the front line fighting COVID-19 may be compromised by a lack of protective equipment and new coronavirus tests, overwork and global staff shortages. In the first report of its kind into nursing and midwifery in 191 countries, the World Health Organization and other senior representatives of the profession also expressed concern at the violence or intimidation health workers face and the need for special protective measures. Here's Giorgio Cometto from WHO's Health Workforce Department.
We're witnessing an unprecedented global market failure in the provision of personal protective equipment. We've seen, again, unprecedented levels of overwork by nurses, particularly those specialized in intensive care unit management or those most directly involved in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, oftentimes without adequate time for rest and recuperation, without supporting systems, limited considerations for their mental health and well-being.
Levels of COVID-19 transmission among health workers have also rung alarm bells, with data indicating a 9% infection rate in Italy 2 weeks ago, a 14% rate in Spain, and more than 100 deaths among health professionals from the new coronavirus. And finally, it's been 26 years since more than 1 million people were systematically killed in Rwanda over the span of 100 days, an atrocity that the UN chief has said we must never again allow to happen. In a statement on the International Day of Reflection on the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on the global community to say no to hate speech and xenophobia and reject the forces of polarization, nationalism and protectionism. While the COVID-19 pandemic prevented the UN's usual commemorative event from taking place in New York, Mr. Guterres urged a renewed commitment to identify the early warning signs of mass killings and collectively prevent all those affected by conflict. Echoing that message, UN General Assembly President Tijani Mohamed-Bande said that it was our collective responsibility to recommit to protecting civilians the world over. In memory of the victims, Mr. Mohamed-Bande urged everyone to counter hatred in all its manifestations. He also saluted the courageous survivors and those who tried to prevent the murders. He also said that Rwanda is now known for its peace and prosperity and added that even brighter days lay ahead for the country's people. In Geneva, the Director General of the UN office there, Tatiana Valavaya, pointed out that the memories of this tragedy are very much alive. Rwanda had learned from the massacre against the mostly Tutsi communities, but also Hutus and others who opposed the massacre, Ms. Valavaya said, before condemning hate speech for eroding shared values and setting back the cause of peace, stability and the fulfillment of human rights for all. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Brian Eno.
The things that we do in the next few months will persist for a very, very long time. The emergency powers that get put into place now will not be easy to get rid of. If you travel in any airport, the residual powers from 9/11 are still in place. So we have to be very careful that we don't end up in a society that is dominated by the sense of fear and emergency and threat.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
It is so hard to grasp the enormity of this time of pandemic and economic collapse. You're about to hear personal reports from nonprofit radio hosts and volunteers, Maria Gallardin from TUC Radio San Francisco. From Australian, Vivian Langford, producer of Beyond Zero Emissions. Soil scientist Jackie Heinle, a volunteer for Red Cross Emergencies and the Radio EcoShock Facebook page. The View from Pennsylvania. From the UK, radio and podcast host Greg Moffat and Chicago radio producer Dale Lehman. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go straight to our five interviews. In America, California is number two worst case in terms of the coronavirus, and I have so many good friends there. Maria Gallardin is the longtime host of Time of Useful Consciousness, TUC Radio, as broadcast in San Francisco and other stations across the country. Maria, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure.
Please tell us where you are in California and what you are seeing.
I'm in Northern California, 120 miles north of San Francisco. And 20 years ago, I ended up on a 4,500-acre former back-to-the-land, I can't really say commune, but those were back-to-the-landers who left San Francisco in 1972. And many of their ideals have since sort of gone dormant. It is still an amazing, vibrant piece of land that has its own roads, its own river or creek coming through, has about 120 people living here. So it's a very different experience sheltering at home than even people down in the valley, in the Ukiah Valley.
In emails earlier this year, if you don't mind me sharing this, Maria, you worried about visiting a friend in hospice in San Francisco and how long that trip would be safe. What is that situation now?
Oh, that is such sadness. It's no longer possible. And it's really mutual. I'm not sure I'm not bringing anything down. And down below, I'm not sure that the hospice workers and visiting nurses don't leave something at my friend's house that I could bring back here. So the shelter in place is a hard rule. There are fines associated with it. They're not being enforced yet, but they're on the books.
And your part of Northern California not very long ago was ravaged by massive wildfires. And now this, are you hearing much about what's happening with COVID-19 in your community?
I do, extraordinarily I do. Even though I can't even see another house from my window, it's that intense an isolation here. I hear the local radio station, which is doing an amazing job updating, responding to listener calls, doing live call-ins with experts. So I know everything that's happening in Mendocino, and pretty much most of it that's happening state, country, worldwide.
But are you hearing about cases in Northern California?
Yes, we have daily updates. We're really lucky in Mendocino County. That's where we are here. We only have 4 cases so far, and none of them needs hospitalization at this point. And they're all travelers having returned. Mm-hmm. So we are just far enough from San Francisco to not be affected by people fleeing the city. That's why the county south of us has many more incidents, Sonoma County. Here are actually signs up along the coast where people like to vacation. Somewhat friendly, saying tourists go home, and people called Airbnb and asked that institution to not rent out places in this area, not send us tourists who want to go for shelter.
Yeah, the same thing's happening here. I live in a rural area, and we closed down the municipal campground, I suppose, to avoid people fleeing Vancouver in their RVs, and we find ourselves keeping track of returning snowbirds from Arizona and Mexico. Are they really self-isolating for 2 weeks? And if not, we have to avoid them even though they are our close friends. It's tough, but a small community has to self-protect.
Yes, and you see here that it actually makes a difference. I'm sort of hating to call it without knocking on wood here, that we've been so blessed so far.
Yeah, the big cities are the hot spots. In Los Angeles, the mayor there expects many thousands of deaths. They think they're just behind New York. And I super worry about all the people with very low incomes who are now out of work, people off the official records. They're not going to get those checks from the federal government. And the many homeless people. Have you heard about any federal or state support for them?
Not federal so far. There's a lot of local support. Mendocino County Board of Supervisors, city councils, and the already existing plowshares feeding the homeless shelters run not just by county funds, but by local organizations. So there's a lot happening already that's locally based, which is kind of astounding because it is so hard to communicate. And people, by and large, respect, you know, not flooding the stores, not holding any meetings. So it's not all that easy to actually function for these institutions. But there again, the local radio station is playing a really important role. There are doctors coming on every day at 3 for half an hour. They give us the most recent updates about the health services. We hear about food distribution by schools. As you probably know, schools are closed in much of the states, really. And so many children were relying on the foods they were receiving, breakfast, lunch, and take-home foods. And all that is still going on. It's astounding. The cooks and kitchens are still open. The school buses carry the food around. Kids can come to places where they usually boarded the school bus, and now the bus comes by and they cheer and they get packages to take home, often for 2 or even 3 days ahead because it's logistically so hard to do it even for one day.
That is amazing. And it does say to me why we really need to keep our local radio stations going, including nonprofit radio. Here, the Canadian government just permitted 100,000 temporary agricultural workers to enter the country to help plant and harvest our crops. And now a nursery operation in the Okanagan, where we grow a lot of fruit and vegetables, it has a serious outbreak of coronavirus among the temporary workers, more than a dozen sick so far. How is California going to safely employ the millions of agricultural workers needed to provide fresh food for about half of America?
I don't know. It's a tragedy, whichever way you look at it. The anti-immigration policies that preceded all this are cruel and short-sighted and criminal, really, as they emanated from the feds. And what is happening now is equally insane. But, you know, our own local affairs, I want to also call out the Transition Town movement here, the many small farms, the food distribution networks that still function. We set up something called the hub, where refrigerated trucks would go from tiny farm to tiny farm and pick up foods from people, fresh produce from people who were unable to also, you know, keep up a farm stand at the farmer's market. So that all still functions. And even our farmer's markets still function.
Those are real solutions. I'm so glad we called you today. Now, you've lived in San Francisco for years. Your program still broadcasts there weekly. What would you say to our California listeners?
Oh, dear. You know, looking backwards at big city living, I'm not sure that any of our large cities are viable for so many reasons, climate change and diseases like this one. They're just too big. A friend of mine once said, cities should not be over 300,000 people. If a city is not that huge, it can actually create its own ecosystem internally. If it hasn't paved over every single available place where you can raise food or plant food trees, it is possible to come up with a more self-sufficient way of living in cities. As far as the country in between, they're devastating. Even today, I heard how many acres of farmland every day are being paved over or become victim to ag industry. So it's pretty bleak. I'm not sure I can give you a hopeful prognosis for California. But there are really good things happening here, even so very locally. Just before going on the air with you, I went down to check out our pond. So Greenfield Ranch, which is the community I'm part of, 4,400 acres, has a stream, salmon stream, going through here. And since 72, people have preserved the spawning or restored the spawning grounds. And we have, in the middle of that part that goes through Greenfield, we have an old ranch dam. And in principle, we're all against dams, and we're applauding them being taken out. But this one may be maintained because we have an agreement as a community with the fish and wildlife people of the state of California. So they're allowing us to close the dam gate, then open it again to release the young salmon that have maintained themselves in the upper reaches. We were unable to close the pond unless one person was going to go down to town and see if maybe some of these industrial building supply companies were open. It's pretty much really reduced only to food. But to our great delight, B&B Industrial Hardware were there and not only had the piece that we needed, a piece of stainless steel, but gave it to us. And that was installed on Sunday to lower the dam gate.
Tell us about your recent broadcast about COVID-19 with Dr. Larry Brilliant.
He was of that generation of interesting hippies who were inspired by Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, who was for a while the doctor for the Indians who had occupied the island of Alcatraz in the San Francisco Bay, and who then joined the pilgrimage of hippies into India. And instead of sitting on a pillow there, he was told by these spiritual teacher who they all wanted to see that he ought to go down to the WHO and help the smallpox epidemic. And he did. And first they sent him back home because he looked like a hippie and they didn't believe he had a medical degree. But he insisted and spent 10 years in India and worked on polio epidemics. And he's bringing his experiences of having actually stopped an epidemic that is 10,000 years old, smallpox. It is something that we can trace into the graves of the pharaohs. We find the evidence of smallpox virus there. It would take too long to explain how he did that, but I encourage everybody to look it up. You know, how can you stop an epidemic? By finding every source and tracking every source. And that's what they did. Years long effort. And smallpox is now officially declared extinct. And he says, he brings us these beautiful words for now, that diseases are totally possible and are even increasing as we are destroying the animal and plant world around us. But pandemics can be avoided.
Find Mariah Gallardin's fantastic alternative radio on the air or at tucradio.org.
Radio EcoShock.
In Australia, Vivian Langford produces radio program Beyond Zero Emissions for 3CR Radio in Melbourne. Vivian, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Not too bad. A little freaked out, but, you know, none of us nonprofit radio types have medical expertise, really, on COVID-19, but we do have our network of personal experiences and people that we have talked to in the community. What is your personal experience in this pandemic? Are you in lockdown?
Yes. I am, and I'm quite enjoying it. In fact, I'm not socially isolated at all, even though physically, because there have been so many webinars by the Climate Action Community. They have these lunchtime webinars with all kind of experts in economics and future renewable energy hubs and things like that. And I found it very stimulating, also very friendly. You know, it's very nice to just see people close up rather than being in a big conference where people say, oh, thank you very much, we've got 5 minutes for questions. And, you know, I feel the unity of people who know about the emergency, have been thinking climate emergency for many years now, are really seeing, well, oh, we're seeing government action on a health emergency, but this, what would it look like if we took a climate emergency approach? I'm feeling heartened, really, by the connection with others and the good ideas that are coming out.
Right. All the things that they said could not be done. We can't possibly shut down business. We can't stop flying. We need the cruise ships. We need the coal. And then guess what? They can. And they did. And I'm hoping we'll see this as a turning point and a lot of people will stay online. They won't have to commute to their jobs. And maybe we can come out better if we survive.
I think so. And I think there's another aspect of it too, because I'm very interested in the cultural side. You know, Extinction Rebellion has regenerative culture workshops and empathy cafes, learning how to really listen to each other and really accept what is, you know, acceptance and kind of a slowed down lifestyle, which is enforced at the moment. But I find it enjoyable, and I think a lot of people are finding it very comforting. Not to be so busy, not to be so frantic, not to be so hedonistic, because people before, I think, were thinking, I work very hard and therefore I deserve a holiday and I need this and I need that. And this has taken all the heat out of that on a personal, on, you know, people's normal life. I've seen in the streets, I've seen hopscotch and little children's messages to each other written in chalk on the street, you know, hello, Angela, can we play after this is all over? And Angela writes back, yes, little quiz questions to each other, just in chalk on the streets. So I think people are showing some, you know, resourcefulness, and I really like to see that.
Yeah, my grandson just had a birthday party parade where his hockey team drove by the house all waving and with signs and balloons and yelling happy birthday. And then others gathered in a huge Zoom sing-along of his relatives and friends. So people are giving it a go to see how they can do it. But I have to ask you, in Australia, how are local supermarkets holding up?
Well, we keep getting messages. Look, Australian farmers are producing plenty of food and they're bailing out companies that export food, like Seaport Food. The government has bailed them out and put on special flights for them to export. But in our local supermarkets, they're having trouble stacking the shelves and deliveries have stopped. Where I am, part of Melbourne, I'm in. And I think that shows that it's very vulnerable. You know, their supply chain is very vulnerable. And at the beginning, people were stockpiling, but you could see why they were stockpiling. I could see that there was a panicky message and people think, well, and you've been broadcasting about this for quite a while. It's a sort of normal response, instead of which government's been critical of people and saying they're un-Australian and they're selfish and so on. But really, they were giving the message of panic and lockdown, and it's not really proactive in ensuring supplies. And the big supermarkets didn't have anything like that. And they just allowed this giant run on everything. And I think they themselves and the government could have sent a message, no, you ration things. And I would very much welcome the rationing and a rationing mentality so that people learn that. And then perhaps 18 months from now, we should start rationing carbon too, so that you have less petrol and less chance to have a high carbon lifestyle.
Less chance to wreck the world. And I wonder, I guess Australia might be able to feed itself if it set that as a goal.
Definitely can feed ourselves. That's why we're an exporter of food. Though we've had massive drought, you know, and the weather, you know, the changing weather pattern here is a huge worry for farmers because it's just not predictable anymore. The pattern has changed. You heard about our terrible bushfires. Really unprecedented, terrible bushfires, and you know the fire people were saying it is beyond us to protect huge forests and the loss of animals and all of that. But people think, oh well, what is it to lose bats and wombats and things like that? But that's not the point. They're all the bats, for example, are pollinators, and we need the whole biodiversity, you know, to keep our agricultural side of life running. You know, we've denuded a lot of the land, and I would think that agriculture, they're producing enough food to feed us, but there's only 25 million of us, but we're exporting. But the, you know, the future for a lot of farming is looking hard in some places. So, you know, we need to be prepared for that. The rain patterns are becoming clear. The long-term climate pattern is becoming clear, and it should not be a surprise if certain parts of agriculture fail.
The federal government in the United States has more or less abdicated its role in leading the country in the COVID-19 challenge. How has the federal government in Australia worked, or is it falling to a patchwork of state governments as in the U.S.?
Well, a worrying sign for me is on the democracy side, they've contracted the government, and so it's not meeting, Parliament's not meeting again until August. And the government at the moment it's not a government of national unity, which the climate emergency people were calling for. It's a government of the cabinet, which is one party, or it's a coalition of two parties, and the state premiers. So they are the people making all the decisions at the moment. And I think under the, you know, it's so ideologically different from what they normally preach. It doesn't come naturally to them, and there's a punitive angle to it, really. It's nothing compared to New Zealand, which is showing good leadership and good sort of communications with the people. So this is kind of abrasive, the way they communicate with us. But the worst thing is under the cloud of the pandemic and everybody locked down, I think a lot of legislation can be passed that will be very enabling to future coal and gas exports, which, as you know, we are a major exporter of those two climate-wrecking products. And that is the worry. And already in Victoria, they've taken the lid off more exploration for gas on land, which we'd had a moratorium on that. You know, we struggled hard to get that, and now that's been lifted. And in New South Wales, there was an amendment before Parliament, which will be passed soon, to make it not necessary for judges to consider climate impacts when approving, for example, a new coal mine. And that was so important. We had two cases where two coal developments were actually stopped because the judge said, in the present context of climate, this is too risky. And we worry about all those things that under the cloak of the COVID emergency, which is reported really ad nauseum around the, you know, close focus reporting on the radio, but not taking that bigger picture, not drawing people's attention to the bigger picture. That worries me.
And me too. Has Australia reached the massive job loss and layoffs that have struck in North America and Europe?
Oh, yes. And it was shocking to show sort of the neoliberal style of government where they make a decision and then kind of go, oh, we didn't guess there would be thousands of people queuing up for assistance the very next Monday. Like they hadn't made a policy and ensuring that people would have a jobs guarantee or a basic income guaranteed. And there are a lot of people, apparently, I think around 1 million people in the category of gig economy or casual workers who didn't have any entitlements vis-a-vis their employers, and they are giving the equivalent of the dole that has been augmented, but I don't think there's any guarantee how long it'll go. We're cutting back on importing workers, and I was interested in your recent show. You said, Paul Beckwith said that something about Mexican workers being imported to work in agriculture in Canada. Well, I don't think we're doing that. We're sort of keeping our borders pretty close.
We probably should have. They approved 100,000. Now, I can see the rationale. I mean, Canadians expect to be fed, and we expect to keep feeding other countries. And right now, our population hasn't been willing to plant and pick crops. That may change as unemployment and fear take over. Maybe we will be willing to do those jobs. I know I'm willing to do those jobs. But we just had a case, as I was talking to Mariah Gallardon about, where some agricultural temporary workers became a hot spot about an hour's drive from me in the Okanagan Valley as they were engaged in planting. Over a dozen are now sick with COVID, and more are. They just haven't finished their testing. So what we feared is happening, and I don't have a good answer for that. So would you talk to us about your recent program on the New Deal and how that plays out for this big turning happening right now due to the pandemic?
Yes, the New Deal, the Green New Deal, there are various versions of it that people are talking about. We've just got the, I've just had an interview, someone else did on the radio, a fresh interview with the leader of the Greens Party. It's a new leader in the Greens Party called Adam Banton. And he's very much emphasising the, you know, the tandem thing of climate solutions being in tandem with job security and, you know, guaranteed jobs. And also the other part of it is the group I'm working with, the Beyond Zero Emissions. We've done a lot of work with communities where they affect the transition from, say, coal or gas will affect that local community. We did a program on Collie in Western Australia, and that would be a sort of Green New Deal program, but really in detail, working with the union. So what can the skill set of those people be used for? And it might not necessarily be renewable energy. It might be recycling lithium-ion batteries, or there was one big industry there, which is ship breaking. You know, they break up ships and repurposing that steel. And that was fascinating, and it was all... Beyond Zero did all this work with Aboriginal people there to be in sync with what their desires were and their approach. So I think the Green New Deal is a massively good, socially improving thing if some of the ideas that are in circulation are put into practice, because it will engage so many poor people and take away this, you know, sort of brain-dead feeling that you have of central government just not getting the right information and not consulting the right people. And even if they consult them, they just don't listen to them and don't take in what they say. And I've interviewed a lot of Aboriginal people about management of the land, you know, different kind of management of the land, and that would create a lot of jobs. And it was a bit like the Roosevelt Green New Deal, which planted billions of trees, I think, in the end. But it wouldn't be like that in a kind of top-down plantation-based way, to be more in tune with the land and the special needs of the land here, which is very degraded. And those Aboriginal speakers were very adamant, look, you know, put us in the driving seat in certain places for forest management, for example, water management. We've got rivers running dry here. We've got the Darling River, which the Aboriginal people call the Barker River, and it's running dry. Last year we had fish, you know, just millions of fish just dead in the water from the toxic conditions of the river, and now the river's dry. So we need big land-based project and energy-based project. And even Beyond Zero Emissions has got many plans for example, not 100% renewable energy, you know, the usual slogan, but 700% renewable energy. And I attended a webinar yesterday about, well, definitely interview those people about how we could not only source all our own needs in Australia, but export energy to Singapore, to Indonesia, to our near neighbours, or to Japan via green hydrogen. And there's lots of aspects of the Green New Deal like that, the land and the energy sector, that lots of people are working really hard now on, and I'm really pleased that they're turning up on webinars and sharing that knowledge with a wider group.
How can listeners around the world find your radio broadcast?
Well, they just type in BZE Podcast.
That sounds easy, BZE Podcast.
Yeah, you'll find it easily that way. The radio station is 3CR, and even though we're remotely, all those podcasts will be available on the 3CR website, as your programs are.
3CR.org. We have been speaking with Vivian Langford, a producer for Melbourne's 3CR Radio. Thank you, Vivian, for this. And, you know, I really appreciate your persistent coverage of the climate crisis from down under.
Thank you very much, Alex. Lovely to talk to you again. And you're doing so well yourself. I think a lot of people do listen to your program, and we get a lot of new dimensions from your focus.
Well, I get a fair amount of email from Australia, so I'm really pleased about that. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is a Radio EcoShock call around to nonprofit radio hosts in three countries, what they see around them as things shut down for the coronavirus pandemic. Jackie Heinle is a soil scientist in Erie, Pennsylvania, and when you find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, that is because Jackie has been that volunteer getting our expert voices out there, and it's just a pleasure to have you on the show. Now, I looked up some news on, here it is, April 2nd as we speak, And the COVID-19 cases in Pennsylvania are above 6,000 and, in fact, added 1,211 cases on April 1st. So over 1,000 cases, new cases a day coming up in your state.
And that's mostly in the eastern part of the state, you know, along the Atlantic. I think that's ballooning out there to be quite a disaster. We're about 90 miles from Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and Cleveland. Here in Erie County, we only have 16 cases, none today, and they were associated, I think, with one of the colleges here, but it's not community spread. Now, south of here in Crawford County, they have more cases. There's a Allegheny College is there, and I suspect, you know, that's how the virus started there. Pittsburgh, Erie, and Buffalo, their cases are all approaching 400, I believe, last time I looked. So far, you know, the town is very quiet. I had to go out on business the other day, and the interstate, there were hardly any cars, so people do seem to be following the stay-at-home orders. Personally, in our house, we're all okay. My niece, though, and her fiancé down in Pittsburgh, he's tested positive. He's ill. He worked at a grocery store, which is not good, and my niece now is showing symptoms. She's been tested. I haven't heard what the results are. That's what's going on in my life.
Philadelphia has been added to the list of 5 developing hotspots in the nation. Have you heard much about that?
Not specifically. Every day our governor comes on broadcast along with our county commissioners and that sort of thing. I think a developing a hotspot will be Pittsburgh, too, frankly. All the major cities, I think, are going to be hit. You know, we just didn't shut down in time. Trump has really made a mess out of things. And, you know, my daughter, she's a nurse out in Portland. She's okay, and Portland seems to have things under control. But here in Pennsylvania, I don't get the sense. In my county, I think things are okay, but I think in the cities, people are still active and going out and just not staying at home as much as they should. Plus, I think the virus has been here for a number of days. And I think you'll start to see essential services start to be the spread. You know, the little epicenter, like my niece's fiance. He works in a grocery store. You just don't know where it's going to come from next. So the best thing to do is sit it out at home. We're well stocked here. I've been stocked for years. I've got Doom boxes ready, and I had my masks in there. We have lots of food supplies, so I hope our listeners have followed your advice and have done the same.
Do you sense people are worried about the food supply?
No, but, you know, I do see at the grocery stores, I made a couple stops. I had to go out for business the other day, and I stopped at a grocery store, and there were empty stocks. They were all out of paper products, of course, but even in the canned goods, I saw, you know, bare spots. You know, I think there may be spot shortages of food. I did see a lot of truckers on the road the other day, but at some point, you know, even they are going to become ill and deliveries will be disrupted.
And you're a longtime volunteer for the Red Cross. I know you have gone into hurricane zones when it looked pretty sketchy to me on the ground. Are there calls for volunteers now with the coronavirus pandemic, or does the need to isolate break the Red Cross playbook?
Well, of course, there was the tornadoes, but they're being handled regionally. And I was asked, there was a call out for volunteers for delivery drivers of medical supplies last weekend. But, you know, I haven't been asked anything. Things are pretty much canceled. You know, all the training that we attend, that's all been put off. And thank goodness we haven't had any national disasters. You know, Pennsylvania is in the northeast section. You know, they call up volunteers in that particular region before they incur the expense of calling up volunteers that are out of the region and having to fly them in. You know, I'm going to suggest to the Red Cross that they assist with the testing because without the testing, you know, they may be sending their volunteers in to, danger zones without their knowledge. My fear is this summer we're going to see a convergence of disasters, you know, major hurricane because of the warmer waters off the Atlantic and the Gulf will fuel another Oh, God forbid we have like a Dorian down in Florida or along the East Coast or something like that again. But if that hits the States, combine that with the virus, it could just be, you know, a true disaster.
I'm expecting we may also have some extreme heat events, partly because the pollution has cleared up so much around the Northern Hemisphere that that's no longer dimming the Earth. And we're just going to have to wait and see that. But it would be terrible to be sort of locked in at home, sweating it out with the gardens and the crops in danger. I don't like that view at all.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I should have gone online to see what the scientific consensus was for that global dimming effect. I don't recall if it was a half a degree or a degree, but that's major. You know, it doesn't sound like much, but if the world heats up a half a degree, you know, within a period of months, you know, that could be something that could trip us going even further. You know, we are in a state of abrupt climate change, and Dr. White's work did show that these changes in climate are more like a change of state. You know, they can happen in a matter of years, less than a decade. We're in for funky times, that's for sure.
And we're hearing about new viruses appearing even out of glaciers as they melt, the things that have never been seen or recorded before. I'm wondering, and maybe this is a crazy question, but does a soil scientist see a different angle on this virus situation?
You know, I do know that most soil microbes, they haven't even been classified yet. One of my friends when I was at Cornell, she was working on her PhD in soil microbiology. So I know that, you know, they haven't even classified most of these organisms. We're finding new ones every day. And then the ones that can be unleashed by this changing climate, you know, my thought on warmer temperatures, now it's been decades since I had my microbiology classes. But one thing I did get out of it was that, you know, higher temperatures, there's more energy in the system. The microbes grow faster and they reproduce more. And whenever you have, you know, increases in reproduction, you have higher probability of mutations and the like. So, yeah, that's another concern.
Thank you, Jackie Heinle, for helping to spread Radio EcoShock on Facebook. I'm really in your debt. You do a tremendous service.
The reason why I volunteered was I felt that your guests were top-notch scientists, and it was very important to get the word out to people about the seriousness of the situation we face. So thank you.
In the United Kingdom, Greg Moffat is the host of a long-running radio program and podcast at LegalizeFreedom.com. His work has been featured several times on Radio EcoShock. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you again.
We're all developing this weird mixture of knowledge. We have a kind of global input through the social media and the news, and then a very limited view out the windows of our home. Where are you, Greg, and what is going on from your perch?
Well, I agree with you about that sort of patchwork of information coming together, and we're trying to assemble it as best we can. I'm located in Yorkshire, which is the biggest county in England, United Kingdom, obviously. The city I live in is fairly small. It's just over 200,000 people, so not big by city standards. It's relatively affluent. And as far as things go, looking out the window and also being on the streets to a limited extent, things are pretty orderly. Yet, of course, they've got that background of extreme weirdness that's everywhere at the minute. But it's more or less every day looks like a Sunday, as Morrissey once sang.
Are people still mixing in the streets in the public in UK? Are they wearing masks?
Masks, not so much. The current legislation, or that's not legislation, it's advice from the government, is no mixing of more than two people unless you all live together already. So you can have three, four, five people together on the street, but only if you already share the same home. Otherwise, it's no more than two. And masks, they've been relatively common in my city here since probably Christmas time, because we have a lot of Chinese students here and they were already wearing them as a matter of course. But I would say there's increasing numbers of people wearing them on the street, but it's still very small.
Did the Chinese students go home for their new year and then return to Britain?
A lot of them are not to be seen. So I suspect that those of them that were able to, I'm not exactly sure what and when travel restrictions became into force in China in terms of leaving and returning, but a lot seem to not be here anymore. So I'm assuming they're back in China.
A lot of Brits have second homes in Spain or travel south for the holidays, and it seems like the UK was slow to pick up on the gravity of what was happening in Italy and Spain. Do you suspect those travel connections raised the number of cases in Britain?
It's difficult to say if travel from those countries has particularly affected the number of cases so far in the UK, but I think a lot of people have commented on the fact that the government's response to this has probably certainly contributed to the numbers.
A record 569 people in the UK lost their lives to this disease as we speak on April 2nd. What do you expect to happen, Greg?
I'm not following the numbers very closely in terms of comparing and contrasting. You know, I'm not constantly looking at graphs or, you know, looking at the latest worldwide picture. So in terms of comparing the UK to other places, that's just not the main part of this crisis that interests me most or that I'm following most. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to suspect with where we are in terms of the prevention measures that have been taken by individuals and by groups, by organizations, by the government, that we wouldn't have a similar trajectory to other countries that are already further along the line than us. The only thing being that countries, China obviously, and other countries such as Italy, who experienced a lot more early on, maybe when this begins to shake itself out, will have learnt something from their experience, so maybe the numbers won't turn out to be so bad. I'm kind of a bit of a passenger here when it comes to numbers. All I know is, I can give you a local report, is we have less than a dozen cases in the city here, and I still don't know anyone personally affected by it. So it's very easy to feel a little bit detached from some of the reporting in some of the more severely hit regions of, you know, the UK. And, of course, abroad, overseas, in the U.S., of course.
Recently, you interviewed James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. And to be frank, I stopped listening to Jim when he became a supporter of the Trump narrative. But, Greg, you have also worried about our loss of freedom and big government. What do you think now that we see the most oppressive sounding measures implemented to stop this disease?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to call, although some people feel that they are in a position to do just that at this moment. As with any major crisis, if we take disease out of the equation, I mean, the last thing of this magnitude in terms of how I feel about it would probably have been 9/11. And we all know that there were draconian measures taken in the wake of that. Some legislation was brought in, more security, more control, and some of those, of course, become sticky. And many of them are still with us. Going to an airport now feels a little bit more relaxed than it did in just after 9/11. But still, it's a different experience to what it was prior to that. So I do have concerns about what's being done now, the speed at which it's been implemented, mainly through our own compliance. But, of course, this sort of atmosphere, it's very difficult to raise red flags or to question legislation when you're in the eye of the storm, if you see what I mean. But I and a lot of others who are concerned about these issues, of course, will be keeping a very close eye on how this progresses over time, particularly here in the UK, for example, when the government do have built into their emergency legislation, they do have an automatic review period after several weeks. So they have to keep coming back to legislation and asking, is this still appropriate?
Well, that sounds good, because as we know, Hungary just fell to an authoritarian government as this disease rages, and I brought this up several times on the show, but Michel Foucault suggested our modern authoritarian state rose out of the needs generated to contain the great medieval plague. So I'm a little concerned that we'll come out of this pandemic with changed social and political institutions, which could be good or may not be so good.
Yeah, I see the potential for good coming out of this. I'll put air quotes around good, because it's a matter of perspective, but for example, a lot of people have already written about, you know, how the biosphere has begun to recover somewhat. I mean, obviously, only in this very short term is a limit to that, but people are talking about cleaner air, cleaner water, wildlife, flora and fauna all looking particularly radiant and even just the air quality in the streets, you know, you can see how people can begin to imagine what could come of this if when this calms down, we look at, you know, what we're doing in terms of, you know, ecology and energy and, you know, economics and how we could take positives from this. And equally, a lot of people are fearful, as we've been discussing, that things might come in whereby you might not be able to travel so easily in the future. You know, have you been vaccinated against this? If you don't have your vaccine certificate, then you can't travel out of this country, maybe not even out of the state. But that could equally be spun as an environmental positive, you know, less international travel. So I could see a lot of potential for freedom limiting here. And I think it's very much, as always with these things, how we collectively go forward with it. But, of course, a lot of the decision-making is out of our hands. It's top-down, you know, control. Those are the societies that we work with. But I see a lot of potential on both sides.
Yes, it's a strange situation because I think in the past, the public always had the option of taking to the streets of protests and great rallies. And now we can't do that. That tool is taken away. I want to ask you, too, Greg, how are food supplies holding up? And do Brits generally know how to cook with food from the pantry, or have they, like Americans, gone to restaurant food and now they're unprepared?
Well, Britain, or should I say the United Kingdom, is very much sort of halfway between the US and continental Europe in terms of those sorts of trends. British people do enjoy, you know, the American imported style fast foods that we've had over the decades. I would say that we're not as far gone, because some of the wryly amusing tales we hear from the American food scene, we haven't quite reached those extremes here yet. So I would say that most people can cobble something together. If they're not confident in the kitchen, they can at least cobble something together. I've only been to the States once, but I don't feel that we're quite, as I say, as far gone as the US seems to be overall. Food supplies, there hasn't really been a problem apart from the usual one in these situations, which is panic buying. I think a lot of correspondents you speak with, I'm sure they'll tell you the same thing, and I'm sure that's your experience locally. If people had bought what they needed, there was always enough to go round. This whole situation shows up immense stresses in many of the systems that we all rely on, one of which, of course, is supply chains. And we have these very short supply chains, and it only takes every shopper or every other shopper to buy one more can of beans, one more packet of toilet tissue, and one more hand sanitizer, and suddenly the shelves begin to empty. So in that sense, we did that to ourselves. But, of course, I understand people are jittery, and they do behave emotionally to situations like this. They're not used to thinking coolly about it. And, of course, the media doesn't encourage us to think coolly about it. They just show pictures of empty shelves. And, of course, people respond to that as you would expect.
Greg, do you expect the British National Health System will be able to provide you with life-saving treatment if you need it? Will it get overwhelmed?
We're in a better position than Italy, for sure, overall. We've got approximately the same population as Italy, about 60-plus million. And Italy does have a problem with their north-south divide, and we have a north-south divide in Great Britain, but it's not quite as pronounced. In Italy, it's the other way around. You have a relatively impoverished south with a relatively poor healthcare provision. In the UK, at the minute, we do hear, you know, a lot of stories from the front line of the National Health Service about personnel being under a great deal of stress, but it doesn't feel like it's that in itself is happening everywhere. Certainly here in my city, that's not happening. There just aren't enough cases. In fact, the hospitals are quiet because a lot of routine operations and surgeries and whatnot have been cancelled. Just to do a compare and contrast with the US, I think the fact that we do have this nationalised healthcare is far from perfect. But I know that a lot of people are very concerned about how the US healthcare system, how that's set up, how that runs, what's going to happen there. Maybe that'll be another lesson at the end of all this, actually, that healthcare for everybody is actually important.
Well, as we wrap up here, please tell us about your podcast and where people can find it.
Okay, they can find it at legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com. You can spell legalize with an S or a Z. Either will get you there. I try to podcast once every 2 weeks on average. It's a wide range of topics. Just drop in legalize-freedom.com. And have a bit of an explore. Energy economy, environment, history, archaeology, culture, politics, economics. It's all there.
Greg Moffat, thank you for speaking with us, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you, Alex. Good luck.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In Chicago, Dale Lehman produces programs for WZRD Radio at Northeastern Illinois University. WZRD also broadcasts Radio EcoShock. Dale, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I am no longer on the air producing programs for WZRD. And because of the shelter-in-place order from the governor, the university has followed suit and closed down the university and closed off access to the radio station, which is operating on robotic program. There is one university official who apparently has access, so they can make some changes, but it's all being done remotely, and the DJs are no longer going in for the time being.
It's the same at CFRO in Vancouver, which was my home station, and this is something I'm deeply afraid of, that some parts of nonprofit radio could go silent, but there is enough automation, and some of our producers are learning how to make programs at home, as I've done for years, so I have some hopes in that respect. Now, on a very serious note, on April 2nd, as we talk, NBC News in Chicago reports 715 new cases in Illinois, not just Chicago, but Illinois. And there's 8,000 people testing positive there and 157 deaths. So now we worry, Dale, is Chicago in the race to become like New York?
I think so for this reason. It has a major international airport through which infected people unknowingly, it was late to order the isolations. And even after that, there were people who didn't take it seriously in the city, so that county officials and city officials ended up closing down outdoor areas that had at first been available to exercise in, but became sites of congregation. They were closed down. I think it is likely to follow suit. There's a shortage of testing, is my understanding. We've had excellent leadership from the governor, as far as I can tell. It's badly affecting people's income. You just go out on the streets. There's not that much traffic up on the north side where I live, and the restaurants closed. What's happening on the south and west side, I can't say, because I haven't been down there, but those are some of the most impoverished communities. There are organizations collecting food to supplement whatever the state or official sources provide.
Yes, cities are getting separated, and we don't even know what's happening for sure on the other side of our own city. That's very serious, and I know massive unemployment is hitting Chicago as it has most cities, and there has been a record of violence there, so it could go either way for the Windy City. A push for social justice, which you and I have been working for, or a decline into chaos. How do you see it, Dale?
There is a push for social justice. We have a phenomenal state's attorney who was reelected in the primary to run for that position, so she's assured of getting it in the general election whenever it takes place. Kim Fox, who has put the word justice into what had been just a criminal legal system, she's really followed restorative justice and programs that have addressed the deep-seated racial history of this country that has seen many, many black youth and Hispanic youth falsely convicted, tortured into confessions, and sent to jail. And until a previous governor did away with their death sentences, facing the death penalty because of a corrupt judicial system, a corrupt state's attorney's prosecutor system, and corrupt police department that tolerated people like John Birch. So organizations in Chicago like the Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, an older group, is actively working right now with legal experts from Northwestern University and the University of Chicago to put pressure on the governor and the county to release prisoners from both Cook County Jail as well as the state prisons. They're being exposed to the virus. I think there's about six or seven a in each of those institutions that have become sick. Others have tested positive. And there's a real urgency to start releasing prisoners that are not harmful to the community. Either they're elderly or they're in there because of some nonviolent conviction or violation of parole.
Or they couldn't make bail. That's another big one. So many people, if you're poor, you can't make bail. If you're rich, you're out. So that's no good. Now, this pandemic has people really looking to their food supply, and there has been a strong gardening and food sharing community in your region. And recently, Dale, you broadcast a talk by Malik Yakini, co-founder of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. Do you have any guesstimates of what the food prospects are for Detroit?
I would suggest you contact him.
Yeah.
I don't. I think he's the person to talk to. He was very inspiring and a longtime activist with experience in the deep-seated racism that has undermined this society to the benefit of the oligarchs, the corporations. And he's been organizing to reclaim our food supply, reclaim our communities, and decolonize our consciousnesses from the corporate mantra that says we have to shop as we're told, we have to consume as we're told. So he would be the person to contact. I recorded that at the Illinois Food Security Conference that took place last month. It's a great local network of people organizing around this issue of how we provide food security, decent food, clean food, healthy food, and empower people to see that growing food and supporting people who do that locally is one way of empowering ourselves to fight this vile system of capital that can do nothing more but expand and destroy.
Dale, do you know people who have been infected or affected in a major way by the COVID-19 crisis?
Personally, I don't. I'm just getting over some kind of flu myself. I don't know if it's the right kind of flu to have given me immunity, but taking about 3 weeks before I started feeling better, although if it was COVID, it was about 4 days before I felt like I was recovering.
Well, this is a thing. I've heard from reports on COVID-19, people who have recovered. I mean, some have lost lung power, 20 to 30% of their lung power, not all, but some. Others have reported extreme tiredness for up to a month and possibly a sense of depression as well. So it's not necessarily over as soon as it's over. It's something we definitely want to avoid, and we want to avoid giving it to others.
Well, I've been following my clinician's advice. I called the clinic I attend to see if I could get tested and was told it's not available unless you are serious enough to be taken to the hospital at that time. Maybe it's becoming more available, but there still isn't enough widespread testing. So I followed the advice and sheltering in place except for going out for a bike ride, that kind of stuff. In my case, if I had it, it didn't affect me severely. And it's such a wide spectrum of whether or not, of how you experience it. I'm of the age group where I'm told I'm very vulnerable. So I don't know. You start to see people on the street wearing masks, but then again, you see people who don't. And thanks to you, I've been following Dr. John Campbell's reports on the development of this pandemic. And I've learned quite a bit about the nature of this virus and why it's different and how it's transmitted. And many of the assumptions about it being similar to the flu no longer hold true. It's far more contagious prior to understanding that you're infected.
You can find Dale Lehman's programs at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. I just searched by producer on the site for Dale Lehman, and there it is. And I'll put a link in my weekly blog as well at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, Dale, for this short update from Chicago. We are out of time for this week. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Brian Eno and Yanis Varoufakis, The Future After Corona. This conversation took place on April 4, 2020. A world-renowned artist, Brian Eno, and the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, are raising questions about the social and cultural consequences of the corona pandemic. Will we be able to design the future of a new civilization, or will politicians and corporations hold on to the extraordinary powers they now have taken? Brian Eno is an English musician, record producer, and visual artist, best known for his pioneering work in ambient music, rock, pop, and electronics. He's also a member of the British Labour Party and campaigned door-to-door for Jeremy Corbyn. Yanis Varoufakis was an internationally known economist and academic when he was elected to the Greek Parliament as a member of the Syriza Party. He served as Minister of Finance in 2015 and resigned when Syriza broke its promise to renegotiate Greece's debt and curtail the austerity measures, which had led to the longest recession in post-war history. In February 2016, Varoufakis co-founded DiEM25, the Democracy in Europe movement, joined by notables such as Noam Chomsky and Brian Eno. To this day, DiEM25 fights to democratize the European Union and stop the rise of fascism in some EU member states. Brian Eno and Yanis Varoufakis were sheltering in place in their homes in England and Greece. They spoke via a scratchy internet connection on DiEM TV, that's archived on YouTube. Yanis Varoufakis is hosting.
I am deeply honored and overjoyed, I should say, welcoming you on behalf of DiEM TV to this latest installment intended to offer escape and hope in this time of confinement and frustration. From where I sit on a tiny island called Aegina, very, very close to the coast of Attica, the coronavirus seems to have had three effects on our political reality. Just three very brief comments on the effects of this virus on our world. Firstly, it has magnified magnificently the never-ending crisis that began in 2008 and which has been morphing in all sorts of different sub-crises. Secondly, it has proved that the government can act and must act massively in the common interest against everything that Thatcher and Reagan have been saying since the late 1970s. Thirdly, this crisis caused by a silly, mindless piece of RNA, this virus, temporarily revealed the true nature of politics, which is the question of who has the power to do what to whom. The question for our evening tonight is very simple. How will this change society? And is there a realistic utopian vision, a realistic utopian vision of society after the virus that can help avert the nastier of scenario of what might happen? In grappling with this question, I cannot imagine a better DiEM TV guest than an artist whom I worshipped as a teenager since the early 1970s and whom I have been honored and so pleased of getting to know in the last 5 years, Brian Eno. the co-founder of DiEM25. You know, I get a lot of pleasure by announcing Brian Eno as the co-founder of DiEM25, who's here with us tonight, with me receding, as I'm not used to be doing, as this is not my occasion, this is Brian's occasion. So Brian, where is the hole in which you are hiding from the virus? Where are we speaking to you from?
I'm in Norfolk, in the east of England, probably the part of England closest to the continent, actually, near where you used to teach, I think. You were in Norwich, weren't you?
I used to ride my motorcycle from Norwich to Ipswich.
Okay, well, you probably passed through this village on the way.
Well, I'm looking forward to coming back to it. So, share your thoughts with us. You know, what would a vision of the post-virus world look like, one which is worth fighting for?
Well, I think we can see the beginnings of it. One thing that I've noticed in the last few weeks is that there's been a sense of relief among people that they could suddenly be nice to each other again. Any of you who know English politics for the last 5 years will realize it's been very, very bitter, very divisive, a kind of anger stoked by the media, particularly the type of media who support our present government. And for 5 years, people have pretty much been at each other's throats. And it seems to me this upsurge of sort of solidarity of some kind that's happened in the last few weeks is not only the sense that we're all in this together, but also the sense of, hey, you can be kind to each other, we can help each other. And of course, they're frightened of the virus, but at the same time, they're sort of delighted to be able to like each other again. That is the beginning of something, I think. And it's something I hope we won't forget. We're rediscovering that we can do creative things together. We're rediscovering that certain parts of the community are very, very important. You know, when they came up with this distinction a few weeks ago of essential workers, okay, those are the ones who are allowed to continue living life outside. It was interesting that nearly everyone that was classified as an essential worker is one of the lowest paid people in our society. The essential workers are the people we don't pay very much, essentially. My middle daughter is a doctor, so she's a junior doctor, so she's in that category. But this wonderful sight of people coming out on Thursday nights and applauding National Health Service and applauding the people who work for it, and not only the NHS, but all sorts of carers. This is sort of a recognition that carers, in the broadest sense of that, are the people who keep society running. It doesn't matter a fig if all the bankers disappear for a year. Nobody would notice the difference. If the nurses disappear for a year, we would notice it the following day. There's a sort of reevaluation among people of who we are and what we're worth. And of course, the nice part of that news is that the health service will be safe for a few more years. It'll be a bit harder for them to sell it off to big American corporations as they were planning to do. So I'm hoping that there'll be a relief on that. But what I think we're facing now is a sort of interesting moment where we, first of all, are designing the future of civilization right now. The things that we do in the next few months will persist for a very, very, very long time. All the kinds of emergency powers that get put into place now will not be easy to get rid of. You can see this if you travel in any airport, the emergency powers, that the residual powers from 9/11 are still in place, and I don't think they'll ever be removed. And so we have to be very careful that we don't end up in that society, a society that is dominated by the sense of fear and emergency and threat. So I'll talk about that for a little bit. I think what we risk now, I'll go back to what we could aim for later, but what we risk right now is the kind of voluntary surrender of power and control to the state. The most efficient way to concentrate power is to encourage a situation in which people are willing to surrender it. And this is a perfect example of that. You know, I was talking to a friend who I would regard as a very sort of liberal anarchist friend. And we were talking about what was happening in China in terms of surveillance and so on. And he says, well, bring it on. That's what I'd like here now. And okay, I can understand in the heat of the situation that you might think that. But we have to be very careful with that kind of sense. Because I think that there's always a sort of dialogue between security on the one hand and freedom on the other. And the more security you have, the more freedom you sacrifice in general. And it's very difficult to step back from a situation of security to say, actually, we don't want that much security any longer. We're prepared to live a slightly more risky life for the sake of having some liberty. That is, I think, is always very hard for people to do. And I think historically, it very rarely happens. It happens with individuals, but not generally with societies. Generally, civilization keeps trying to, of course, gather more security of all sorts of things. Now, the people who would like to control power understand the value of an emergency situation like this. For instance, just think of after 9/11, what happened when suddenly there was a huge industry built up called Homeland Security. And Homeland Security has had hundreds of billions of dollars spent on it. Nobody really knows what for, but it's a self-sustaining feedback loop, you know. And it gave rise to this wonderful phrase of the 21st century, for security reasons. That's the way you are told that there are certain things you can't do. You can't do them for security reasons. And that is a kind of unquestionable phrase. It doesn't even need to be explained. You're just told for security reasons, you cannot do this. It's a way that the powerful justify protect their actions, basically. What we are now, I think, is we are sort of going onto a war footing where one way for democratic governments, so-called democratic governments, to achieve consensus is to create a threat big enough for people to all want to agree, all want to do the same thing, not complicate the business of government. And war is a very good way of doing that. You know, we can see in the past how often it's been used as a resort for rulers who feel that they're threatened. They imagine or generate or create or promise a war, and suddenly the population is unified. Or in fact, it becomes possible to enforce unity. But to have a war, you need an enemy. In the past, those have been other tribes or other races or other nations or other ideologies. Even recently, immigrants were the enemy. That's what gave us Brexit. But I think this is the first time in history that we've actually declared war on another organism. As you say, not even a very impressive one. It's a piece of RNA. But it works because it gives you all the benefits of being at war. It enables you to constrain social freedoms and so on and so on. I understand fully the need for those constraints right now. I am worried, and I think we have to be very careful to make sure that they don't fossilize in place and become the way we live. So now, to go to the more positive aspect of this, what kind of future could we imagine other than that rather dark one I just suggested as a possibility? What I'm really hoping is that the skills that people are learning in these few months, maybe it's going to be longer, the skills of sociability, of being together and working with each other and getting around the huge gap left by conventional industry suddenly stopping. I hope that those skills will become part of the way that we build the future. Richard Sennett said something very, very nice in his talk last night on this channel. He said, solidarity is a craft. And I like the idea very much that It's something we work at, something that we do together, something that we have to practice and something that we have to refine, not something that happens automatically. He also said, I don't believe that solidarity is the product of rage. Yes, think about solidarity not just as the result of anger. Anger is part of it. We need a bit of that. But we also need reflection and care and thinking about each other and saying, what can we do together? What can we do together now that we could never do before? Because remember, we have lots and lots of new tools. We're using one of them now, actually. You know, the fact that we can have conversations together 1,000 miles apart, and thousands of other people can witness them and in some sense be part of them. So there are new tools for the craft of solidarity, and I hope we'll use those.
But speaking of solidarity, if I may interject just for one moment, the recognition of essential workers. Slavoj Žižek on TMT the other day said something really pertinent. He said, those millionaires, billionaires who isolate themselves on their yacht in the middle of the Atlantic, they cannot isolate themselves unless there is an army of working for them on the bloody yacht, right? So there are essential workers. And I remember when DiEM25 was putting together our European Green New Deal, we made a point of extending solidarity between the innovators who are essential because they create tools like the ones that we use now to communicate. But we also made the point of honoring and referring to the maintainers, to the ones who maintain all technologies, like sewers, like national health services, providing food to elderly people at home. This is very low-tech craft. This is the craft of solidarity, as Richard Sennett was saying. So now we have an opportunity, you know, to highlight that which DiEM has been trying to do, which is to say, yes, we need innovation. We need to support the innovators, but we need to support even more the maintainers. But my great worry, and this is my question to you, is this. The fascists are pretty good at looking the maintainers in the eye and saying, we are going to look after you. We are going to make you proud again. Saying Mussolini, Matteo Salvini, Donald Trump. Giving them, in my view, a false sense of importance on the basis of hating others, of demonizing the foreigner, the black, the Jew, the German, you know, the Palestinian, doesn't matter who it is, the other. So how do we navigate in the midst of this coronavirus, this terrain where the heart and soul of the maintainers is being contested by the Boris Johnsons, by the Kyriakos Mitsotakis in my country, by the Golden Dawn, by the Alternative for Deutschland, by the nationalist internationalist?
Well, I think this has become much clearer in England recently. Everybody knows that the NHS has been under attack for quite a long time. And suddenly, they're the heroes, even to those politicians who've been responsible for attacking them. I don't think there's too much ambiguity about it right here and now in England. We suddenly do realize who the essential workers are, and we realize who has been supporting them and who hasn't until now. Of course, the difficulty is that the fascists are always prepared to lie. They'll just make it up, and they'll rely on their control of the media to make people forget that they ever said what they said. I mean, the performance of Trump in the last few days has been astonishing, where he's consistently said things like, I always knew this was a pandemic, and I always knew this was, and apparently a lot of people believe him. It doesn't take very much research to see him saying exactly the opposite. This is a sort of media problem.
Now, I've got a couple of questions from our audience, if I may. Will this virus change the normal of the West, or are we facing the end of normal?
I think we're facing the end of normal for a while, yes. When you told me the title for this, The Future After the Virus, I thought, I actually have no idea at all what the future is going to be like. I know what I hope for, and I know what I fear. But very likely, the result is going to be a mixture of both of those and more, you know. So I think the end of normal has already happened, actually. I don't think we're going to just get the industries working again and slip back to the 9-to-5 jobs. There are going to be so many things changed. For instance, just as I say, what we're doing now, how many business meetings are not going to happen as a result of this? How many flights are not going to happen because people think, you know what, I can do it on Zoom. It worked fine. Or I can do it on whatever platform.
People fall back to old habits and ways very quickly. You know, once this bloody thing goes away, we are going to have much greater levels of poverty because, you know, so much money has been pumped into the financial sector by central banks that the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times are going to be celebrating the immense recovery of capitalism. But of course, real level investment in quality jobs and in care jobs and so on will have plummeted. But who gives a damn? In 2008, I have to tell you that I felt that was the turning point. Capitalism has never recovered since then. At least financialized, globalized capitalism has not recovered. Don't you feel that, you know, in 3 years' time, 2 years' time, 5 years' time, you know, this COVID-19 thing is going to be remembered more or less in the same way that 2008 was remembered? And then the same old establishment will be reviving the same old claptrap about, you know, the importance of having a budget surplus and fighting, you know, those who are constantly asking for the states to create money on behalf of the many.
Yep, I think that's very possible. And I think that our mission is to make sure that that doesn't happen. That really is the mission, particularly of artists, I think. Artists are the people who, in a way, provide the sort of material for imagining different futures. That's one of the things you do with art. Art is a way of trying to experience what it would be like to live in a different world. And that world might be represented by something elaborate like a Charles Dickens novel or War and Peace, but it might be represented by something as simple as a pop record. It's all about what you do when you make art, is you make something that gives you the chance to experience another set of values and relationships and so on. And we've really got to start working on this now. That's really got to be our mission, I think. I think we have a little window when people will still remember this period, possibly fondly in some ways, like British people still remember the Blitz as though it was the most wonderful time of their lives. And why was it wonderful? It was wonderful because for the only time in their lives, probably, they felt unified, they felt together, and they really belonged to something. And I think what matters to humans more than anything else, more than money, is a sense of belonging, a sense of being part of something. And people love that feeling. When they don't have it, they fill that by various false sorts of belonging, like owning stuff, having that red sports car. It's a surrogate. And I think for a little while, for the next maybe 3, 4, 5 years, people are going to remember this time. It's a spectacular difference in our lives. And what we have to keep telling is the story of what happened in this time that was special and unique and positive and wonderful. And I think a lot of artists will be working on that. You know, we know the bad side of the story. It's awful. People are dying. People are living in terrible situations because they have to stay in one small room with a large family. All of that. We know the bad side. We have to also try to remember we can learn something from this.
I feel what you're saying in my bones because I remember I grew up in a military dictatorship. You know, we were constantly in fear of the police breaking down the door and abducting my dad, my mom. But the beauty of that awful military ironclad oppression was because you could recognize the bloody enemy. They wore a uniform. One question we have from the audience is this the end of neoliberalism? Because you see, the problem with neoliberalism is that unlike a military dictatorship, unlike the Blitz that you mentioned, where you could see the Stukas, you could see the Luftwaffe, you know, you had tracers in the middle of the night, and you could see the bombs coming. You knew where the enemy was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with neoliberalism is that no one is at fault. And this is the intense and irreversible, to some extent, power of neoliberalism, mm-hmm. that no one is at fault in the end. So do you think that COVID-19 is going to be to spell the end of neoliberalism?
I just read an interesting essay by Douglas Rushkoff called Post-Human Utopia. Have you seen that? I don't know if it's a recent piece or not.
Yes, I have.
And he describes going to a meeting. He was hired to talk to a meeting about the future, what technologies will be around and so on. And he went to the meeting, which paid him the equivalent of half his salary as a university lecturer for a year. So it was a very big sum of money. And there were only about 6 or 7 people at the meeting, and they were all very wealthy men. And what they really wanted to know was, how do we escape? How do we get out of this situation? They felt that the situation was already on a trajectory towards doom. There was no future. They weren't talking about coronavirus, by the way. It was before that. This was just the general notion of, you know, the future is a mess. How will we get out of it? Or how will we protect ourselves? Now, these are the same people who own ranches with huge numbers of proletarian guards around them in Nevada and places like that. They're people who really don't see a future. Now, these are the wealthiest people in society. So it's interesting to me that they have given up trying to guide society in any way or to try to mold it. All they want is to protect their world, their power and their privilege. And the rest of us, we're going to burn in hell for all they care. So it's kind of encouraging to me that they've given up. That means that we can take over if we're lucky, if we're smart. You know, we can't, after this crisis, go through a repeat of the 2008 scenario where everything goes back to some kind of normal. We have to say, look, we've realized now that social services matter. Care matters. Caring is what a society does for its inhabitants, and it needs to be paid for. So I think this will be a very good time now to start saying tax havens, let's get rid of them. I think it would have a lot of popular support now.
I'd go further than that, if I may. I would ban share markets. I'd like to live in a world where, you know, you work for a corporation, the moment you enter, you have one share, like a library. You can't buy it. If you don't work in it, you can't have one.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's another question.
I like it.
That was part of a conversation between Brian Eno and Yanis Varoufakis, the world-renowned artist and musician and the former Greek finance minister. They spoke on DMTV, that's archived on YouTube. DM25 stands for Democracy in Europe, the movement of the loyal rebellion that supports the European Union but wants to save it from the large banks and corporations. They call DMTV, quote, our media playground, away from the mass media dictatorship. This is our stage, your home, our newsstand, end quote.
You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.